and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg. Of course, as usual, powered by Research Luxembourg and straight from the studios of RTL. And yes, we move to another guest, and this time it is Christoph Puschke, who is an associate professor in computational linguistics at the Institute for Luxembourg Studies. He's also the head of the newly founded Culture and Computation Lab, a transversal research unit for cultural data science hosted at the Department of Humanities of the University of Luxembourg. Christoph is committed to the development of digital language resources and applications for Luxembourgish, as well as to the active dialogue between science and society in the context of participatory research projects. I would also add that there was a lot to say about Christoph, but I wanted to make it short, so there you go. Christoph, thank you very much for coming today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So already in the introduction of your person, there was a lot that I don't understand exactly. So we start with computational linguistics. What's that?
Okay, I'm still in the process of finding out, honestly. So I'm a linguist by education. I came in from German linguistics with a specialization in looking at the German dialects that we have. And then I decided to move more into the social aspect of language, looking at the relationship between language and society, how it changes, and what are the factors for language to change. And at a certain point, I decided that I also wanted to be able to do things by looking at computers, because they'll allow us to do things at larger scale. So we cannot only look at 10 interviews, for example, but at 10,000 interviews at the same time. And in order to be able to do this, I needed to look into computational aspects of doing linguistics. So the basic translation would be using computers to analyze language. There's a lot of things that we could add to a definition like this. For example, there's people who come into computational linguistics more from the linguistic side of the story. These are normally the people that we call computational linguists, as opposed to people who come in more from engineering. These are normally the people attached to a label called NLP or natural language processing. But I like to think of them as sort of brothers living in neighboring houses, staring at the same sunset from slightly different angles.
But their cooperation is needed. One cannot function without the other.
Well, technically they can, but they would profit from cooperating, yes.
And this is what you're also working with, not what, but who you're working with when it comes to the people at the lab, right? It's mm-hmm. both the more engineers and more the linguists.
Yes, that has always been my personal interest, but this is also part of the hiring policy for this new lab that you mentioned, the Culture and Computation Lab, that we're trying to bring in people with different backgrounds, people who come in from computer science or NLP, and people who have a more humanities or scholarly approach in their research, and try to team them up and see what happens.
And for the lab, when it comes to the abbreviation, is it KUKO or KAKO? Or what do you do with that? Because in theory, it's culture. So I was just thinking it should be KAKO if you really want to be precise or not.
Yeah, just have it your way. So I go with KUKO lab whenever I'm asked, but it's just a label. So
okay. And this lab has been created this year. It's pretty new, as you mentioned. So what happened in between? Why did you decide to, I mean, not you only, I guess, to have it? Was there a need here in Luxembourg? Was it just something that was not really happening anywhere? What was the reasoning behind?
We had been thinking about creating a unit like this in the department for a couple of years already, when suddenly this year we got the opportunity to hire some people and to actually found this little research unit that sits sort of in the middle of the entire department. It's not part of any specific institute, not even of the Institute for Luxembourg Studies that I am a part of, but it's there for everybody in the department. So it's also a service institution that we're creating, because we want people to be able to invest more in digital research. So combine their humanities background with a digital strand of research, be it the analysis of historical documents from the medieval times or language, or whatever you can think of, philosophical texts, for example. So we want to enable people to do the research that they do in a digital way also. But also, being a linguist by education, but having a vivid interest in computational aspects of processing, analyzing, and understanding language better, hopefully, we thought it might be a good idea to really create a unit that combines these different interests, not only for me personally, but bringing me in as a person who has all these different interests, at least, and get something started that can also help us to looking at Luxembourg and the Department of Humanities particularly to position us better in the national research landscape. You might know that the research priorities that the FNR is setting, that also the university and the country are setting, are very much focused on digital aspect, data science. So it's getting more and more complicated for, let me call them, traditional humanities projects to get the funding we need in order to get done what we want to do. So we thought having an institution at the department that can sustain and support these projects also for applications would be good. The second aspect is, if I look at computational linguistics and NLP in particular, we're at an interesting point right now, because the engineers that I mentioned earlier are suddenly realizing that language is not only a technical problem, but a social issue, right? Language is embedded in culture in its very core. So we need to also engage linguists, scholars, humanities researchers of all kind in this kind of research in order to understand better what we're doing when we're trying to model language technologically, and also to get these applications that we're building with computers to process language with less biased. So doing this at a humanities department is crucial, I think, to activate all the different kinds of knowledge that we have and help the engineers and the technical persons to develop products that are better and help us better.
That is a very interesting look at this, also because it's true that when we talk about digitization, when we talk about digital assets and all the trends, we tend to focus more on the engineering side. And I also noticed even digital competences, when you discuss them, they are more about, okay, are you able to code, mm-hmm. right? And not necessarily this ability to be still a human being in the digital age, right? To keep the soft skills going, but using the computers as such. So this is really, really interesting. But I was thinking, there is already C2DH that is doing a bit of digitalization. Do you overlap? Do you cooperate?
We cooperate, of course. Yes, we have contacts in the center, of course, and we're trying to build something together. Also, because the C2DH is coming from a historical point of view, we also have an Institute for History Studies at the Department of Humanities, so there's an overlap, certainly. But we also have other scholars in the department. We have philosophers, we have different people analyzing different languages, different literatures. So there's a wider space of topics involved, also of people involved. And I think together we can create something that could be very interesting also for the development of the research landscape in Luxembourg.
Of course, I'm pretty sure, and I'm sure we're going to be still discussing that soon or later. But coming back to the definitions, you told me computational linguistics. I think I'm kind of grasping that idea. But then we also mentioned the natural language processing, mm-hmm. and you said that's more the engineering side. So what is it really?
Well, it has been for the longest time a way of accessing language data. Language data as in languages that naturally occur in human culture, be it in written or in spoken form, and find ways to model it, to analyze it, and to also process this in a way that we can build applications from it. For example, you can think of machine translation as an application using DeepL or Google Translate. You just put in a sentence and you get a more or less accurate translation in a couple of different languages. And this would be a classic application of machine learning or a natural language processing, taking a large amount of input, written or spoken language, and transform it in a way that you can use it for a different purpose, or model it in a way that you can analyze certain aspects of what's going on in language.
So it's a question of actually feeding the algorithm with enough data so it learns from it and then translates it into something, or it's not that simple.
That's part of it, but that's also part of the limitations that NLP is currently running into, because you might know that all these companies who have huge chunks of data from our daily lives because they collect it, all the social media platforms, for example, there's still the belief that the more data you might throw at a language model or at an algorithm, as you say, at some point the problem will be solved. For example, the problem of language. And I can't say whether or not this is accurate, but I can say that right now most of the models that we have that do linguistic tasks, for example, translation, or also speech-to-text systems that listen to you and then transform this into some form of written language, fail at certain points. For example, irony. No computer can understand irony. Also, if you look at the machine translation systems, many systems, all systems, in fact, have problems translating gendered language into a different language. If you have a female doctor and a female patient in a German sentence and you translate this into French, suddenly both the doctor and the patient are male. Because there's a certain bias built into these models. They feed from the data that we have, mostly internet language and other sources that are available, and these reflect on human perspective on the world somehow. So there are certain elements in there that at which models and all the technology that we have still fail. And this might have to do with the fact that language is in fact something social, something cultural, and not only something technical. So this is also where we come in, like looking at this from a linguistic, from a humanities point of view, trying to make understandable that just sort of throwing data at a model does not necessarily make it better.
But you still have to transform it somehow into programming language.
That's
and how
true.
Do you manage to do that? Because this is more philosophical. It's more abstract
yes.
way of thinking. We're talking about context. We're talking about where you're using the language, but also the society and, you know, all that. How can you transform it into zeros and ones?
That is a very complicated process. So the transforming language seen as a series of information that you have somewhere, be it words or characters in a written text, into zeros and ones, that is sort of simple because this can be done, this can be matched and labeled and then translated. But for all these cultural concepts that we have, for example, irony, there's no zeros and ones for that, right? Even people have problems identifying when somebody is ironic or not, or sort of seeing the underlying meaning of an irony in some sentences. So we're currently working on ways, on new ways of labeling language data to better understand what information needs to be put into the machine in order to better understand what irony is or what gendered language use is. So for that, we urgently need people who have a background in humanities, in linguistics, for example, who have experience in analyzing and understanding language from a cultural, from a social point of view. But this is far from solved. So I don't know how to solve this properly, but this is one of the reasons why we wanted to create this laboratory, to hire people who can help us do this.
I can't imagine labeling irony, also because I have a problem with that myself, as sometimes I'm ironic and people don't get it. So I have a feeling that it's so much cultural and also like just personal, you know, all the sarcasm that I like using, and then people get offended. So yes, I definitely wouldn't be the right match for the lab.
Yeah, then you should also factor me out, I think, because I also have a reputation for being quite ironic often, and I keep running into problems with that, so... Maybe I'm not the right person to run this lab. Who knows?
And then we want the computers to manage. And we're both kind of saying it's not us then.
Yeah.
That's going to be tricky. But yes, what you mentioned is exactly this analysis and the human factor and all that. And I also know that you prepared a pub quiz question that is mm-hmm. a bit related to errors as such, right? So could you please ask the question? And please, listeners, remember that the answer will be only at the end of the podcast.
So my question for you guys would be, if you ask a computer to analyze hundreds of thousands of texts written by Luxembourgish people writing Luxembourgish, how many errors on average would you expect one person to make in 100 written words? An error in this case being any kind of variation that is not sort of part of the official orthography, right? Because we call it an error because this is what we can count. Something can be correct or false. But of course, when we consider Luxembourgish as a very young language that has not been written for a long time, people also have individual ideas of how to write it that are not technically false, but would be considered as an error by a computer. So when I say error, I mean variations, but that would make things more complicated.
It's interesting that you have to make a disclaimer here, right? But in case of Luxembourgish, I know we do. I mean, I myself have the Sprachentest and have mm-hmm. been trying to write Luxembourgish, but I struggle a lot exactly because of the fact that if I get an email from someone, I start thinking like, but I don't think this is how you write it. And then I realize that it's just because exactly, I mean, it's so much of a spoken language still and not so practiced in written form. And I notice also the preference of some people. We speak Luxembourgish, but I get an email in French. I mm-hmm. guess just because they don't want to make mistakes or they're just not used to writing it.
Yes, that is true. Also, I think what I noticed recently that people sometimes start making excuses for not writing back in Luxembourgish. And that is a new phenomenon. Or people correcting other people online when someone writes something incorrectly. So this is a very interesting and also very special point in the development of Luxembourgish as a written language. People are starting to develop this idea of we need to write properly when we use it, but we don't know how, so either we don't, or we make an excuse for not being able to write properly, or we find a way around it. So, and this is also something that I'm very much interested in. So how a new written standard language evolves in real time.
Luxembourgish is such an interesting language to study for a linguist. Honestly, I do envy you in a way, because there is just so much to see, to check out, and it's developing at the same time as you're studying it, right?
Yes.
So what are the main challenges for you right now when you study it, and what are your main interests as a linguist?
Well, one of the challenges, maybe to start with the more difficult things, is that we have, compared to other languages, sort of little data, right? It's a small language community. There's a lot of things going on, but still, compared to larger languages such as German, English, Spanish, Chinese, we have little data, which is also a problem for computational analysis. In order to be able to teach a computer certain things, you need a lot of data. And we don't always have that for Luxembourgish. So this makes things more complicated, but also Luxembourg studies as a discipline, both in literature studies and in linguistics, is relatively young. So for many aspects of what we normally do as linguists, we do not have studies yet. So in many cases, you will be the first person to explore a topic, which is nice. But it also leaves you with a lot of fundamental work that you need to do that nobody has been doing yet. So this can be challenging, but it's also super interesting. I sometimes describe this to foreign colleagues as finding El Dorado. Everything is shiny and golden, and you just have to take something out of the sort of out of nature, and it's new and shiny and fresh. Nobody has been working on this, so just take it, hide it somewhere, and do something cool with it. And this brings me to all the different things that are interesting in Luxembourg, because there's so many things happening right now. First thing, as I said, we are witnessing the emergence of a new written standard language right in the middle of Europe right now, with the digital technology to analyze this also by using computers, which is super. That's a very rare thing to have. Then Luxembourgish is embedded in a complex form of multilingualism. There's other languages around that influence Luxembourgish, French, German, English. So there's new words appearing in Luxembourgish. There's other kinds of contact between these languages. And then there's also, of course, a political side of the story, because so languages do not live in a vacuum. They are always embedded in a society. And as you know, we are having a couple of discussions about which languages should be put front center when it comes to language support, also from politics. And are there languages that are too present maybe in public space, and all these things that are currently being discussed. And this is also interesting to look at from an ideological point of view. So what are the different people engaged in supporting and developing a language? Ministries, for example, or school teachers, or everybody who's in sort of in charge of making a language happen. What are their motives? What are they trying to do? And how does this influence the development of multilingualism? So this is also something that I've been looking into over the last years.
And it also brings me to, I have to reveal to my listeners right now, for those of you who don't know, I have actually a linguistic background. Mm. So I often get questions like, oh, so you're probably like a biology student or something. No, I'm a linguist. And one of the things that you always discuss as a linguist is, should grammar be prescriptive or descriptive? Okay. So the question for Luxembourgish, what do you think? First of all, with the spelling, I guess there was a body that gathered and said, like, we spell like this. Is there like an Académie Française in Luxembourg that did that? Who decided on the spelling?
Mm-hmm. So there has been an official version of the spelling rules that also has changed over time for a couple of decades already. And this was assembled from different sources that were already there. But as you might know, recently the Ministry of Education has founded a specialized center officialized a specialized center, the Center für Letzeburger Spruch, that is in charge of language development and also of language standardization. And they are sort of monitoring language use and developing suggestions for how to keep the orthography up to date. So this is one aspect of how to develop a language, looking at orthography and making sure that there are rules that people can abide by when they write this language.
But there are other rules as well here. I mean, for grammar, for example, what do you do with grammar? Do you listen to the people or do you actually say, no, this is the standard one because it's closer to German? Oops, I shouldn't be saying that, closer to German. I don't know. What's the approach here?
Well, it depends on who you ask, I think. So I, as a researcher, I'm always on the side of the actual people, like looking at what people do, just document and analyze the variations that we find in language and then have some idea of the direction maybe in which Luxembourgish as a language is developing. So technically, I don't care about whether or not something is a correct form or an incorrect form, as a grammar theorist would, for example, do, because it's what happens in language. But there's, if you're trying to develop a standard language, for example, there have to be certain rules identifying uses of language that are preferred as opposed to others. And this process of deciding what is good use of Luxembourgish or what should be considered a good form in Luxembourgish, that is still ongoing. So there are ideas of how to standardize this aspect of language as well. And it might be necessary even for language teaching, where if you learn a new language and you have a couple of varieties of the same language, it might be difficult to get an idea of which one should I learn in order to be successful when I speak this language. And so for learning and teaching, this might be useful. But on the other hand, it would prepare you having the different variants for reality, because you might learn one variant in your language class and then you go out and say this and you get some other word back that you don't expect. So having variation also in language teaching and learning might be good for preparing people for reality somehow. So, but as I said, there are people who are in charge of standardizing, of developing an idea of a standardized language use, but it remains to be seen how this goes. And also these people, of course, are looking at what actually happens in the language, because you cannot standardize a language sort of next to reality, right? You always have to be in touch with what people actually do.
This is a bit more similar to analyzing a dialect as well. It's kind of more living, if you want or not.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, technically speaking, Luxembourgish is a dialect of German, or was a dialect of German before there were, of course, developments that transformed it into the official language of Luxembourg. But it still has a lot of context with German. It's still also similar with the dialects that are spoken on the other side of the German-Luxembourgish border in the Moselle region. So you could technically speak your Moselle dialect here. The only thing is, normally Luxembourgers answer in German if you do that, because they hear the difference between the Moselle dialect and their Luxembourg. But yes, this is also what we do when we analyze dialects or any other kind of variation that language has, looking at what people actually do, compare it, for example, to the idea of a standard language or to other dialects, and then see what happens.
I asked about dialect because I know that you also have background in dialect research. Mm-hmm. And I would say that with dialects, you just can't say, okay, this is the standard and we are just really far from reality. Dialects are so much into daily life, if you want, right? So much more than a language.
Well, it's hard to make a distinction between a dialect and a language, because there's a famous saying in linguistics that says that a language is only a dialect with an army and a navy. So it's sort of difficult to say when a language starts and when a dialect stops, because also what we consider to be a language today, Luxembourgish, for example, used to be and is still in some regards a dialect of German. So these are more social concepts, not necessarily linguistic concepts.
True. And it's also our personal feeling. I don't know why it is important to say language sounds more, I don't know, dignified than a dialect, which whatever. It's the thing that unites us in some way, makes us a group of people, right? Yeah. So it's again the societal aspect of it, I would say.
Yes.
For sure. Okay, so that was Luxembourgish, but of course we can discuss a lot about that, but there are other things I wanted to look at as well. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're also involved in the, well, citizen science projects, let's say. So a little bit we move away from Luxembourgish, but also it's in Luxembourg too, the research that you're doing. So this is Linkscape. Mm-hmm. And what is it?
That is a project that tries to involve people in the variety and in the complexity of language in public space. So we have a mobile research application that you can download for iOS on Android devices and just go out and make photos of written text in the public sphere. Can be any form of text, posters, stickers, shop signs. It only has to be written and has to be public, and can upload it to an interactive map that we host on one of our university servers, where we collect all the submissions from people. And what we get there is a very interesting and wildly mixed data set of things that people find interesting in public space. And we use it to show and to analyze how, for example, Luxembourg as a multilingual society is also multilingual visibly if you walk through the cityscape, right? You have different languages out there. And we wanted to have a tool to collect what is out there in terms of text and make it comparable, make it visible to people who are not in Luxembourg, for example. So it's technically a citizen science project. Everybody can participate. But we are also working with schools. We're working with university colleagues all over the world. We have a project on Hawaii, for example, but also we have colleagues in Austria who work with this app a lot. But we also have people from Luxembourg, private citizens, who just submit photos because they're into this kind of research. So it's in a way about creating a sensitivity for the richness of language that we have in public space and transform this into sort of a research project, because this is what I'm paid for, doing research. But why not do it sort of while being in touch with society and what happens out there?
Yeah, it's a great thing. I'm very much for citizen science in general. And I also had a guest a couple of months ago from the Museum of Natural History, Paul Brown, who was talking about digitization, but also he is actually responsible for the Luxembourgish iNaturalist. Yes. I don't know if you know that. So exactly, we're discussing also this data collection and also the pitfalls of that, because it is all cool, but then people upload strange things too. Do you have some kind of a filter there, or it's just not that much data? How does it work?
Well, we have decent amount of data, but still we go over all individual upload that we got to see if it's in fact language in public space, or if it's something off topic. For example, we had a project with one school class where the students made photos of each other, for example, and uploaded them to the application, which is fun, of course, to see who's actually working with this application. But then again, we're not allowed to show this on the app. Also, in some countries in which we work, there are regulations in place for what you are actually allowed to photograph in public space. So we need to make sure that everything that we have is on topic and can be shown in the app. So we look at every submission, but up until now, we haven't edited much, or sort of we can make individual photos invisible if we want, but we don't do that much because we want to give people the opportunities to see that their contribution matters. So for example, if you upload something in the application, it directly appears in the application, also on the internet map, which bears a certain risk if people would start, for example, do some like making photos of each other.
Okay, so dear listeners, don't go do that straight after the episode.
We haven't had this much. And even if you try, we can monitor that somehow. But we haven't had this much. But we wanted to have sort of a direct reaction to what you do. We could, for example, have some sort of filter or editorial system in place that puts your submissions into a key, and then we look at it, and then maybe we release it to the internet. But that can take hours or days, and by then you might have lost interest already. So we wanted to have this immediate reaction to what you do, sort of being open to the risk that it bears.
Yes, but it's true. It's less off-putting if you want, right?
Yeah.
Because you're just not putting in this internet hole, and then you forget actually that you had this app, you deinstall it because you say, yeah, whatever.
Yes.
No, they don't react, right? So that's why. Oh, good approach, I think. I actually might even install it myself, because on the way here today, I noticed a very interesting ad that was all in Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised because it's, you know, we're in Kirchberg, so I would not assume that such an ad would be put in Portuguese here. Somehow this is, I have a feeling that you know, this is more kind of international English speaking environment. So I was thinking like, this is an interesting contribution to the app for sure.
Absolutely. And this is exactly what the project is about, because once you start noticing how rich and diverse and also surprising language in the public sphere can be, you cannot unsee this. It's like a hidden superpower that you unlock. During the first months of this project, it was impossible to get somewhere with me. Like, for example, on the way to the cinema, I was all with, oh, look, there's Corinne. Just one photo, okay? And then we can go on. And it took ages just to get somewhere, because there were so many interesting things that I suddenly started to see. Also being relatively new to Luxembourg, like having trilingual signs somewhere that are completely normal for the people who have been living here for a couple of years. They don't even realize that these are three languages, maybe, as opposed to a newcomer who sees this and says, well, that is interesting. So making people aware of what's happening and how beautiful, technically, the main purpose of the project.
And this awareness, for sure. You see, you already worked for me, so probably it's going to take me more time today to go back home.
Hopefully.
Yes, but for sure, I just started noticing things, which is perfect. You mentioned that there are certain rules for taking photos in certain countries. Is that also for Luxembourg? Do we have any problematics, places where we shouldn't be taking photos, or haven't really encountered that?
Well, of course, there are technically restricted areas, for example. Military terrain cannot be photographed that easily, but that is not so much our issue here. There are countries where it's not allowed to take photos of things in public space. Technically, for example, in France, it would not be allowed to take a photo of the Eiffel Tower because there's limitations in the law. Nobody abides by these rules. But this is not even so interesting for us. For us, it's more about there shouldn't be people visible in the photos because people have other rights as opposed to things in the public sphere. So we're trying to guide people also in the instructions that we give in the app to avoid making photos of people, for example, sitting next to a sign for something. That is what we're caring about the most.
Okay, we are talking about multilingualism and Luxembourg. And I also know that recently you published a paper that was kind of an analysis of both the situation in Luxembourg and in Switzerland. So what can we say? How different are the countries? Both multilingual, exactly the same situation, almost the same languages, right?
Yes, they are similar in many ways when it comes to being multilingual, for example. Also, with regard to having a high percentage of foreign resident population, it's 25% in Switzerland on the average, as opposed to 50% almost in Luxembourg, as we know. There's also a certain concentration towards financial industries and international institutions that are located in Switzerland and Luxembourg. They're also decently sized as opposed to other countries that surround them. So they seem to be similar in many regards. But when we look at multilingualism and how it works in society, the countries are very different. We have a couple of languages around. They also overlap. We have German, we have French, we have Swiss German, like the local Swiss varieties that the people cannot decide upon whether they should be considered a language or a dialect, but still, these are different ones as well. We have sort of Luxembourgish in Luxembourg as a similar variety or language that has evolved from German and is now present technically as a language also. And then we have other languages in Switzerland that can be added to the puzzle. But what interested us in comparing these countries is, despite this similar setup and also the languages that are around, multilingualism works completely different in both countries. In Switzerland, you have a very regionally organized way of multilingualism. You have a certain region that is mostly German-speaking. Of course, there's also multilingual persons living there, but everything that needs to be done can be done in German. Then you have the Swiss Romande, right? You have the French-speaking part of, then you have the Italian-speaking part, and then you have the little fourth language in the East. As opposed to Luxembourg, where you cannot say, well, this is the French-speaking part of Luxembourg or the German-speaking part, right? There are certain regions like close to the borders that tend to be a bit more influenced by the respective languages. But in Luxembourg, it's more about having all languages everywhere at every single moment.
And always being ready for surprises.
Yes, that is also something that I noticed when I came here, that at the beginning of conversations, we tend to have these micro negotiations about which language will we speak in interaction, right? You can offer, for example, by using greetings. If you say Moin, for example, you signalize that Luxembourgish could be an option. If someone then replies Bonjour or Guten Tag, you would already know, okay, it's not Luxembourgish, it's going to be French or German or something else. And this is something that we need because we cannot rely on the fact that we are now in a specific region of Luxembourg and we know that German is always an option. But you have to find out what are the languages that we share and which one can we use in conversation.
For me, the interesting part is when I go to a pharmacy, at least here in Luxembourg City, I am pretty sure that I'm going to speak one language before getting the medicaments. And when the pharmacist is back, she just he forgets which language we were speaking and we switch into something different.
Yes.
So I understand it's a lot of clients. It's difficult to remember, okay, this one. And also they always have, you know, like seven flags there. They always speak a lot of languages. Yes. So it's natural.
That is also something that is peculiar in Luxembourg in that you have on the name tags of people in many shops and commerces, you have people indicating the languages that they would be willing or able to speak. That is also due to the fact that you have to expect all the languages at any given point in time.
And coming back to multilingualism as such, because that always fascinated me, it's always presented, at least in my view, as this very positive thing. we're always excited about it.
Yes.
There's the discussion, oh, this child speaks seven languages. I'm losing seven again. Five languages. That's so great. Is it so great actually or not? What is your opinion? Are you in favor of multilingualism or not?
Always.
As a researcher?
As a researcher, always, because it makes things so much more interesting and complicated in people's heads. Like having a couple of different resources or languages that you can use qualifies for a couple of interesting context also, right? You start in one language and you finish the sentence in a second language. Or you stay in German or Luxembourgish and you just borrow one word from French to put it into your sentence because your brain in this particular second has forgotten the German or the Luxembourgish equivalent. Right? So there's so many ways of mixing, of profiting from having different languages around. But it also has certain consequences for the way a society works, right? You have to be able to speak certain languages to do certain things in Luxembourg, for example, right? You might know that for many people, when they go to the supermarket, their default expectation is, oh, I'm going to speak French, because there's many people working in the private industry that come in from a French-speaking background. So you have certain expectations about which languages would be needed or adequate. And this also, of course, has consequences for ideologies and politics, right? Because people then can get the impression that, oh, back in the days, I was able to do everything Luxembourgish around here, and now I can't because there's so many French-speaking people around or many foreigners around. So this multilingualism has consequences for the way we organize and we talk about society. So for me as a researcher and also as a person, it's definitely a plus, but it has, as I said, implications for how a society can work.
Are you a purist when you speak? You stick to one language or you just mix all of them?
No, I'm definitely no purist. I tend to stick with one language when I use it, but also I switch a lot in between. Because, you know, brains are lazy and your brain is very efficient at always fetching the word that seems closest cognitively. I came in from Germany. I spoke English, French and German when I came here, and a low German dialect that nobody knows about here. So, but I learned Luxembourgish just from listening and repeating and trying to come up with my individual version of Luxembourgish, which then qualifies, of course, for a lot of mixing German-Luxembourgish at some point. Now, I guess I'm at a point where I can speak proper Luxembourgish in terms of not switching in between Luxembourgish and German too much. But still, having all these other languages in the back that are always active, I tend to just grab a word from French if I need it, or from English, and then put it in my sentence just to make it more beautiful, more fun, or just because it happens. So no, don't expect any kind of purism from me.
Because for me, it's personally very frustrating when I try to speak Luxembourgish and I have the background a bit in German and a bit in French, and I know that I need to get some piece of vocabulary. I know it's a word that probably is from German or at least similar, or from French, but I don't remember which one. Mm-hmm. And then those, you know, I always think about the brain that the drawers open and the wrong one opens and I just get stuck there.
Right.
And it's, for example, classic me is when we are at the table and I need to remember how you say the spoon. And you see now I don't remember even in English, and the knife, right? And I know that one is more like German and the other one's more like French. Actually, no, spoon, no. It's the fork. Yes, the fork, and that's it. And I'm just completely blocked. And then I remember only Polish. And so that switching thing, I guess it's also something you are born with and it's easier for you maybe, or you learn it. I don't know. I do speak quite a lot of languages, but there are certain ones when it's easier to switch and certain ones that it just completely gets into a mess and then I can't do anything anymore.
Yeah, I know that feeling. But luckily for us in Luxembourg, there's always people on the other side of the table who also speak a couple of languages, and there's always common ground for making each other understandable. If it doesn't work, you can still point at things that works. But I remember when I came here during the first months or even during the first year, in the evenings, I was so tired because of this constant switching going on. You could never rely on, okay, for the next 3 hours, I will talk German straight. That never works. So in the evening, I was always tired because I had to activate and use the other languages that I had in my head. And I wasn't used to that much, because working in a German environment mostly qualifies for using German and or English. But here you need sort of to be able then to listen in Luxembourgish, then say something in French and go back to German or English. So that made me tired. After a while, I noticed that I'm not noticing this anymore so much. So you can, I think, also learn multilingualism as a separate competence, not only in your language, but the fact that you are living in a multilingual environment.
At least from your example.
Well, yes, maybe I was lucky. I don't know.
Maybe, or talented. I don't know.
Nah, no. Wouldn't go that far.
Okay, because I'm not there yet, but hopefully one day. Although at the same time, I have to say that at home, we speak three languages and these we switch all the time.
Yeah.
So then it's also a question of how well you speak, right? I mean, it depends on where you are with the level and how easy it is for you to switch.
Mm-hmm.
So that must be related as well. But we are slowly coming to the end of the podcast. I just realized, looked at the clock. Oopsie. So we have to look at the answer to the question that mm-hmm. you asked in the beginning. So can you please remind our listeners what the question was and then tell us what the answer is?
The question was, how many errors or variations does an average Luxembourgish writer make in a text of 100 words? And to find out how this looks, I took all the data that I could get, for example, all the user comments that people have been posting on the RTL news website, and asked the computer to analyze them as for orthography and other kinds of deviations from standard orthography that we could find, and then come up with an average error rate, as I call it now, per 100 words. And the answer would be 36, which can be considered a lot if you look at how other languages can be written properly or not. But then again, we have to consider that Luxembourgish is still developing as a written language. So, and you can see this, you can trace this over time, how people are slowly, like the first comments that I have are from 2008, the latest are from 2022, how people are slowly closing in, zooming in on the official spelling rules and try to write other versions, better versions maybe, or more correct versions of Luxembourgish over time. So this is something that's truly fascinating. And this can only be done by using computers, for example, right? Looking at hundreds of thousands of texts over 20 years' time and compare them as for being spelled correctly or incorrectly.
Yeah, I guess here also the question is that it's not, especially for the older generation, it's not that you could learn the spelling at school.
Yes.
So it's really a process. You either, I don't know, did some additional studies. You had to make an effort to actually learn how to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I guess, through analysis of what RTL is writing or any other media in Luxembourgish, and I know that they do make mistakes sometimes as well, right?
Yes.
You kind of start seeing, okay, this is probably the variant, or you rather go to the Bibles of Luxembourgish language. I don't know. Are there any places where you're sure everything is correct? I guess LOD?
Yeah, the LOD would be the primary source for, like, the Luxembourgish Online Dictionary would be the source to consult if you want to be sure that something is spelled properly. You know that there's also the online spelling correction tool, the spell checker, the way you can enter your text and sort of get suggestions for what should be corrected. But everything else is out in the wild, right? So also the texts on RTL written by the journalist used to have some typos or spelling mistakes, because where would these people learn how to write properly, right? It's not, as you said, being taught in schools. So where would you get access to the official spelling rules? And this is what we also have witnessed over the last years, that, for example, the Ministry of Education is trying to promote the official spelling rules in Luxembourgish. Like, you see posters out in the wild, for example, of which you can take photos then and put in the app that we have. But you can see, like, they're also giving away books with the official spelling rules to tell people more about how this language can be written officially. But then again, as long as you can communicate successfully, why would you care about official orthography, right? But that's just me.
Yeah, it just reminds me of my dialect. I have no clue how you write it. I mean, and somehow if I write something, most probably others will understand what I tried to say, although I'm not very strong at this. So that's a different story once again. Just out of curiosity, for Luxembourgish, you know, I just went back again in time of my studies. And whenever you do linguistic studies, you talk about corpus, mm-hmm. right? So this collection of sentences, words, texts that you analyze in order to understand how the language works. You can do a lot of things. What about Luxembourgish corpus? Is there something like that for the studies?
There is a text corpus that we are assembling at the university that contains basically all the text that we can get our hands on. As I said, we are in contact with RTL and we get all the texts that are published on their website, both the news items and the user comments. But we also get data from other sources. We could download data from Twitter, for example, collect these short messages that people now slowly start to write more in Luxembourgish on this platform. There's text also from the parliament. So speeches in parliament are then transcribed in Luxembourgish as well. And we can have access to these texts as well. So we're trying to assemble everything to create a corpus that is as big as possible for then ask the computer to do stuff for us. But this is also true for spoken Luxembourgish. We have another application at the Institute for Luxembourgish Studies called Schnüssen, in which we ask people to translate sentences from German or French into Luxembourgish or to record their own spoken Luxembourgish. And we can collect this to create another corpus of spoken Luxembourgish, for example, that is now being used to train a speech-to-text system for Luxembourg, so automatic speech recognition, which will also be interesting.
Absolutely, and that really needs a lot of work to collect enough data for the spoken word,
yes.
I guess.
And one of the tools that we used in order to collect as much data as possible of spoken language was this mobile research application called Schnüssen. That is also still active. You can still participate in this if you want to.
So small call to action, you know. So first of all, take pictures of signs, whichever language, and use the Linkscape, I just remind you. And then Schnüssen as well is still there. You can still contribute.
Yes.
But I guess you have to be a native speaker of Luxembourgish for that.
No. We have, in fact, most of the speakers that we have in the app are native speakers of Luxembourgish. But you can participate at any level of proficiency, and that would be even more interesting to see how people use Luxembourgish that have not always been speaking Luxembourgish. So this is also something that I'm interested in. What about the other half of the population? How do they look at Luxembourgish from a ideological point of view, but also how do they make use of Luxembourgish? Right? How does the contact of all the different people coming into the country and learning the language, how does this influence the development of the language, for example, right? Do people who come in from a French-speaking country use more French variants in Luxembourgish as opposed to people who come in from, for example, Germany? Do they use more German-influenced variants in Luxembourgish? You know that we always have two, or in many cases we have two, right? An equivalent that comes in from French and from German, and you can still use both in Luxembourgish. There's no reason to say one is better or one is worse, but it could be interesting to look at how having all these foreign resident speakers around influences Luxembourgish. So even if you are at B1 in Luxembourgish, just go for it.
Okay, so perfect appeal. Definitely, I will, as usual, put all these references in the show notes if you want to participate. And this is just the time to say very much thank you to Christoph Pöschke today for coming to the studio and talking to us about computational linguistics and so many other things, Luxembourgish included. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me and for listening.
So this is it for today. As usual, thank you for listening. As Christoph said, don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to rate, and just to check out all the different platforms where we are. Don't forget that we are now also on RTL Play, on the website, and Apple, Spotify, everything else. Check what we are writing about on Twitter, on LinkedIn. This was Silux, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.